You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 516. Storytelling is the most powerful way to put ideas into the world today. Robert McKee.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Vidafair. In a world where filmmakers are trying to find new ways to generate revenue with their films, Vidafair lets filmmakers set their own price for a 24-hour rental of their work, which includes features, docs, and perfect for short films. This is truly a revolutionary way for filmmakers to generate revenue with their content. For more information, head over to vidafair.com. Well, guys, you are in for a treat today. I have on the show the legendary storytelling instructor, Robert McKee. Now, if you're not familiar with who Robert McKee is, he is the author of the best-selling book on story called, oddly enough, Story. He's also written two other books, Dialogue, and his latest, Character. Now, if you guys saw the movie adaptation with Nicolas Cage, written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by Spike Jonze, you might recognize Robert's essence, if you will. Brian Cox plays Robert McKee in adaptation. And it was the first time I was really introduced to Robert. And I think in many ways introduced him to a whole new generation because Robert McKee has been giving seminars on stories for decades now. And it was the seminar, storytelling, screenwriting seminar to go to in Hollywood. And his students are vast, including just epic giants in this, in the screenwriting space like William Goldman and many more. And we really had a wonderful conversation about story, dialogue, and character. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Robert McKee. I'd like to welcome to the show Robert McKee. How are you doing, Robert?
Very well. Very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am have been a fan of your work for quite some time. I've read your first two books, and I'm looking forward to reading your new one, which we'll talk about later, Character. But I was first introduced to your work in the film adaptation, like so many, screenwriters and filmmakers were. By the way, how was that whole process? I mean, it was a very odd request, I'm sure, that you got when you got that call.
Well, it certainly was. My phone rang one day, and a producer named Ed Saxon calling from New York, and he said, "I am mightily embarrassed. This is a phone call I've dreaded. We've got this crazy screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, and he has made you a character in his screenplay, and he has freely cribbed from your book and from your lectures, and he has no permission to do either, but we don't know what to do." So I said, well, send me a script and I'll see what's going on. So they sent me a script and I read it. And I saw immediately that he really needed my character. Mm-hmm. My character was essential to the film because he wants me to, he wanted my character to represent the imperatives of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And that you have to do certain things, certain ways, blah, blah, blah. And which is on one level, nonsense. Mm-hmm. There are no such rules. There are principles and there's genre convention, but anyway. So it was a typical kind of need to slander Hollywood in favor of the artist. And they wanted me to do the slandering. But I realized that without my character there to provide some source of conflict, the story didn't work at all. So I said, I tell you what, I made two phone calls. I called William Goldman and I said, because he was a student of mine. And I said, Bill, there's a film and they want to use me as a character in it. What do you think? And he said, don't do it. Don't do it. He said, it's Hollywood. And he said, they're out to get you. Don't do it. I said, yeah, but okay. But suppose I had casting rights. And he said, okay. Who do you want? I said, well, let's say Gene Hackman. He said, okay. It'll be Gene Hackman with a big pink bow around his neck. If they want to get you, Bob, they're going to get you. Don't do it. So then I called my son. And I said, Paul, and he said, do it. I said, why? He said, because, Dad, it's a Hollywood film. You're going to be a character in a Hollywood film. And he said, it'll be great. Do it. So I talked to Ed Sachs and I said, I need three things. One, I need a redeeming scene. I said, you want to slander me, fine, but then you can't leave it at that. You got to give me a redeeming scene, right? Two, I have to have the control of the casting. I won't tell you exactly who to cast. But you got to give me a list because I didn't need to know their philosophy. I mean, for all I knew, this was the Danny DeVito, Dan Aykroyd school of casting,
Fair enough.
and then I said, and very importantly, the third act sucks. And I cannot be a character in a bad movie. So we need meetings. They're going to have to be willing to rewrite and those are my three conditions. And they agreed to them. And so they sent me on casting. They gave me my redeeming scene. And then they sent a list of the 10 best middle-aged British actors alive, everybody from Christopher Plummer to Alan Bates. And I looked at the list and I said, I want Brian Cox. And they said, who's Brian Cox? And I said, he's the best British actor you don't know. Because Brian had been a student of mine up in Glasgow, and I'd seen him on stage in the West End of London. And what I didn't want, see, all those actors, they're all wonderful. But there's always, actors have this love me thing. No matter what, they want to be loved. And there's always this subtext like, my heart's in the right place. And I know, and I don't want to be loved. I really don't. I want to be respected. I want to be understood. And I want to inspire people and educate. But I do not want a bunch of people following me around like a guru, right? Loving me, right? And I knew that Brian would not do that. And then we had meetings about the Act 3. And And eventually it never got to a perfect Act 3, but it got to a point where I could sign off on it. So, it was, so then I took my son to a screening at Sony, and I said, you know, what do you think, Paul? And he said, Dad, he said, Brian Cox nailed you, which I thought was great. So, you know, and but that's not the, you know, I played myself in a film called 20 Days. So it's not just, but yeah, it was a difficult choice. But I think William Goldman was wrong that, you know, there was a way to have your cake and eat it too. And I think an adaptation is loved by millions and millions of people. So, so it certainly didn't hurt my brand.
It didn't hurt your brand or business, I'd imagine. And it's the term irony comes to play where you would be working with Charlie Kaufman on a script where your character is the establishment that he's trying to get away from and give art, but yet you are working with him to put the script together and finish the third act, which is amazing.
Charlie's one of those guys. He's got, you know, a great talent, but he's a bit delusional. What he wants to achieve is the commercial art movie. He wants it both ways. He wants to be known for making art movies, but they have to make money too, and a lot of it. Because he knows that his, you know, his career, if he loses money, it's over. And so he wants to create the commercial art movie. And Saul Zantz understood, you know, things, the notion of the commercial art movie, you know, the English Patient and films like that. And I, you know, I, in the meetings with Spike and Charlie, I, you know, I pointed out to Charlie, I said, you can't have it both ways. I said, you know, if it's a true art movie, it has a very limited audience, period. And art filmmakers understand this and they budget accordingly. You want $30 million.
For an art film.
For an art film. It was $5 million. We could, but okay. So anyway, but it was, the irony of it is wonderful.
So you've worked with so many screenwriters and filmmakers over the course of your career. What is the biggest mistakes you see screenwriters, new screenwriters to the craft make?
Well, it's not mistake so much. I guess it is a mistake, but there's two problems. One is cliches, and they think that that they want to be, you know, like an artist. They want to be original, but at the same time, they want to be sure that it works, and so they recycle the things that everybody's always done. And they try to recycle them with a difference, and which is absolutely necessary. I mean, I get it. You are not going to reinvent the wheel. You have to just spin it yet another way. But then they get very, you see, once they sell their soul, it's hard to get it back. And, you know, you can pawn your soul for a while, but, you know, you got to get the cash to get it back. And, and so that's the war on cliches is not some, you know, it's not a fault. It's just a problem everybody faces. But there's a greater problem. And it's the willingness to lie in an effort to tell their story, to get it out somehow, to get it together. They will write characters and scenes and whatever that lack credibility, that they know perfectly well in their heart of hearts is pure corn of some kind. And it's they're bending the truth. It's not, it's, there's something false or something. And to get to something that is really profoundly honest, and it doesn't matter what the genre is, from action to comedy to an education plot, something very interior. Doesn't matter what the genre is. There's truth and then there's lie, and somehow they think that because it's fiction, that gives them a license to lie. But they don't have that license. They have an obligation to express the truth of what it is to be a human being in whatever genre they're writing. They have an obligation, if they're writing comedy, to really stick a knife in some sacred cow and expose the bullshit of society. I mean, it's not enough to be amusing. Comedy is an angry art that savages all those things that are false in life, and starting with politics, right? And so there's a willingness to fib and lie and in order to please that. Okay, let me take a step back. Both of those things, cliches and truthfulness, are all the byproduct of the young writer, especially the young writer's desire to please. They want to be loved. They want people to love what they do. They want to please people. And so they write what they think is pleasing for people, whether it's all the car chases in Fast and Furious, right, or the sentimentality of whatever. They want to please people, and which is fine, but you can't please everybody. And so you're going to write for a certain mind, a certain audience, a certain mentality and educational level and taste and whatnot, in a certain group of people that you know are out there that are like you, and you can't please everybody. And so a film like, for example, Nomadland, mm-hmm. is certainly not trying to please. There's an audience for it that will get it and enjoy it and recognize this is a deep truth about our society and about human nature. But it's not going to have a mass audience, and because it will turn off more people than it will turn on. But it's a excellent film. It's an honest film. So I think it's fishing around here, because when you open the door and say, you know, what do they do wrong?
Well, there's thousands of things.
Thousands of things come pouring out. But if I could nail it down, yeah, it's that the willingness to please results in recycling cliches and basically not telling the dark truth of things. You have to be, it's tough. You have to be disciplined not to copy other people's success, but to write what you honestly believe to be the truth of the characters in the situation, you can genre choose, combine genres, and be rigorous about that.
Now, one of the hallmarks of a good story is conflict. How do you create conflict in a story?
Well, depends on where you start. If you start with a choice of genre, let's say you're going to write a thriller, right? You know the source of conflict immediately by that choice. I need some kind of psychopathic villain, right? I need Russell Crowe in Unhinged.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And so that's done for you. So the genre sort of automatically tells you, right? On the other hand, if you're telling a family story, what we call domestic, so the characters are a family, and it's a family with problems. Well, the conflict could come from any direction. Is it the mother? Is it the father? Is it rebellious children? Is it some older grandfather, grandmother figure that's pulling people's strings and, you know, whatever. Given a family, what's wrong with this family? And so you have to figure out is it social or psychological? Is it instinctive? Is it deliberate? You have to think your way through all of that. And so you start with a family, you create a little, you know, a cast, and then you ask the question, you know, what's wrong with this family? And a million different things can be wrong in human nature inside of a family. That requires knowledge. You have to understand people. You have to understand the mother-daughter, mother-son, father-daughter, father-son relationships, and you need to dig into your own experience and ask yourself, you know, what was wrong in my family? What do I believe to be the truth about families? And that the genre doesn't give you that answer. Mm-hmm. The answer will come from your depth of understanding of human nature, human relationships of a certain personal kind in this case. Or if you're writing comedy, as I was mentioning, the starting place of writing a comedy is to ask yourself, what is pissing me off? What in this world is pissing me off? Is it relationships? Is it men, women? is it the social networks? Is it politics? Is it the military? Is it the church? What do I hate? What's pissing me off? Because the root of comedy is anger. The comic mind is an angry idealist. Comics are idealists who want the world to be perfect, or at least a hell of a lot better than it is. And when they look around the world, they see what a sorry, sick, wanting place it is, and they realize that they're complicit. They're part of it too. and so, what's pissing me off then? It points them in a direction to an institution or behavior in society. I mean, like, take that great comedy series, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. You know, and yes, you know, what is pissing me off? And he, you know, finds really egregious fault in people's lack of propriety or logic or clarity of thought. You know, why should there be a handicapped stall in toilets, right, that no one can use except the two times a year that a handicapped person comes into this particular toilet, okay? Right? That is to Larry David, that is an egregious absurdity, and it infuriates him. And so he goes into the handicapped stall, and sure as shit, this is the day a guy in a wheelchair. So that's... Those are the various things. You look at yourself as a writer, and you have to understand your vision of life. You have to understand the genres, when you make a choice, there's certain conventions, and you can bend those conventions, you know, what, break them if you want, but not without an awareness of what the audience expects. And so somehow, you know, between picking the setting and the cast and the genre, and then looking inside of yourself like a comic would and asking what's pissing me off, you find your way. You find conflict, and and most importantly, you know, that conflict has to be something you deeply believe in.
Now,
or you will do what we were talking about earlier. You will fall prey to cliches because you'll create false conflict, false antagonist, empty cliched antagonisms, like that. So it's a very important question.
Now, so as far as one thing a lot of screenwriters try to get away from is structure, saying that structure and trying to fall into side of a structure is it's like holding me back as an artist, and I need to be free and I need to run free like a wild stallion. I personally find structure to be very freeing because it gives me a place to go. How do you approach structure?
Well, in this, the people have, of course, accused me of imposing structural rules in my teaching, and it's nonsense. When people oppose structure, the people who say that, I am opposed to structure, it's inhibiting my creativity, do not know what the hell they're talking about. They just don't. They use the word structure, but they wouldn't understand or know story structure if it fell from a height under their foot. Okay? They just don't know what they're talking about. Structure. In every scene, ideally, is a turning point of some magnitude in a character's life. They go into a situation wanting something, and something in that moment prevents them from getting it. They struggle with that, and they either get what they want or they don't get what they want, or they get it at a price, or they don't get it but learn something. Change takes place, and in a simple scene it's minor, and then these changes per scene build sequences in which moderate, deeper change, wider change happens. These sequences build acts, and an act climax is a major turning point that has greater depth or greater breadth or both of impact on a character's life. And so minor, moderate, major changes are building a story progressively to an absolute, irreversible change at climax. Now, why would anyone object to what I just said? Why would anyone think that you cannot change, that you can create scenes in which nothing changes, and do that three scenes in a row, and people will not be walking out? They come there, they come to the writer, they read a novel, trying to have insight into life as to what forces in life, positive and negative, bring about change outwardly or inwardly in characters' lives. I mean, that's why we go to the storyteller. And so why would you not want change? Or why would you want repetitious change?
Right.
Because the same change, degree of change, that happens three times in a row, and we're bored. So because it's not giving us what we want. It's not giving us the insight that into character that we want. And so people who say they're opposed to structure don't understand what structure is. They don't understand. It's a dynamic of a progression of minor, moderate, and major changes. And so I have no patience with that kind of ignorance. Here, The people who say that are the very naive, ignorant, really, people who think that if they just open up their imagination, a motion picture will flow out of it.
Very true. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And they are childish in that way. I mean, you open up your imagination and see what flows out, then you have to go to work on it. And you have to step back from every time or let me put it to you this way. What in truth is it to write? What is writing actually like as an experience? You open up your imagination, you have an idea for a character or two or three, and you write a page. Things happen. Action, reaction, dialogue. Okay? You write a page. That takes 20 minutes. Then what do? You read that page. And you critique it. Does this work? Would he say that? Would she act like that? Would this happen with it? Is there a better way to do this? Is this repetitious? Is there a hole? Does it make sense? You constantly critique what you've written. And you go back and you rewrite it. And then you read it again and you critique it again. And this goes on all day long. And so you go inside to create. You go outside to critique. You create, you critique, you create, and the quality of your critique that guides your rewriting is absolutely dependent on your understanding of the art form. So that you can make judgments. When you ask the question, does this work? You have to know what works and what doesn't work. On one level, everything you do is structure. It's structure to have a character say X and another character respond with Y. Mm-hmm. That's structure. Action, reaction, that the person who said X did not expect to hear Y.
Right, okay? Exactly.
And that's structure. That's a beat of action, reaction, and human behavior. That's structure. So, as I said, people who say this, say it amateur understanding of what the creativity, what the act of writing really is.
And I whenever I've come up against that, when I say no, every movie has some sort of structure, or most movies, especially popular movies, have structure, and your definition of structure is wonderful. They always throw out Pulp Fiction, and I'm like, no, Pulp Fiction is an extremely structured film. Would you agree?
When they were doing adaptation, and I was working with Charlie Kaufman, Charlie had exactly that attitude. I said, the third act doesn't work. We have to restructure it. And his face went into a panic mode. He didn't want, scared the hell out of him. He said, it'll come to me. It'll just flow and whatnot. And he says, I don't write with structure. He said that. I don't write with structure. I said, Charlie, would you like me to lay out the three-act design of Being John Malkovich? I said, because it's a three-act play. Mm-hmm. You want to hear them? Act one, two, three. And he almost ran out of the room. He didn't want to hear it. He wants to live in the delusion that it somehow flows and there is no structure, when in fact, subconsciously at least, Being John Malkovich is a three-act story.
Yes, agreed.
It's a model. Being John Malkovich is a model of three-act design. But to the romantic, like Charlie, he doesn't want to hear it. because he thinks that that's going to constipate his creativity. And I have to agree with him. If he wants to write out of this notion that it's all a flow, and if he is aware that there's a design happening, it would inhibit him. So it's because he's a good writer. He's very talented. So it would be better for him to live in that delusion and let it all pour out. And then he goes back and his taste guides the rewriting and so forth. And so if you're talented like Charlie and the idea of structure is frightening, then you should listen to those feelings and not think about structure and just, you know, do what you do and hope it works. That's rare.
Very, very, very rare. But yeah, and so for everyone listening, you have to understand that someone like Charlie Kaufman is writing, and as he's writing, he's subconsciously working within the three-act structure on a subconscious level. And even the great writers who's like, oh, I never even think about outlining or plotting, is because they have such a grasp of the craft that it's already pre-wired in them. It's like me building a house. I wouldn't even think twice about how to pour a foundation or how to lay out the walls because I've done it a million times. I don't have to sit there and think about it. It's just done. But that is rare. And it takes sometimes years to get to that place, or you're a prodigy, which happens once in a generation or twice in a generation.
And you're absolutely right. That's very, you know, very well put. And in fact, it goes beyond that. You have been watching the stories on screen. You have been reading them in novels. You've been to the theater. That form is a better word than structure. Mm-hmm. That form of action, contradictory reaction, reaction to that, and a dynamic of action reaction building to change, that is so built into you as a reader, as an audience member, from when, I don't know, 2-3 years old.
Yeah,
mother reads you little, you know, bunny rabbit stories, right? The little bunny rabbit goes out and something happens that's not happy for the bunny rabbit. And then, you know, Bunny Rabbit's mother comes along and fixes things, whatever it takes. I mean, that form is ingrained in you from the earliest. And so you do know it.
Without question. Now,
you do know it.
Dialogue is something that is, you've wrote an entire book dedicated to dialogue. Yeah. Obviously, your first book is story, but your second book is dialogue. What are the three functions of dialogue, in your opinion?
Well, there's many of them, and certainly one of them is the obvious one of exposition by various means. So, for example, simple in writing dialogue, a character has a certain vocabulary. So, for example, you've done construction on houses, right?
So I'm sure.
Okay. And so how many different kinds of nails do you know? From spike to tack to whatever.
Let's say 10.
10, okay. Now, most people know 2, maybe.
One nail and a screw, basically. That's all they know.
Right, okay. So if in their, if a character in their dialogue uses the carpenter's terminology and even metaphorically, you know, calls something a 5-penny nail, right? The fact that he knows the difference between a 2-penny nail and a 5-penny, whatever it is exposition. It tells us something about the life of this character by the very words, the names of things that this character uses in their vocabulary helps us understand the whole life of this character. So if somebody grew up you know, around boats, and they use nautical terminology, right? And so the language inside of the dialogue, all that, just the vocabulary alone, gives us exposition. It tells us who is this character, what's their life been like, etc. Okay, then at the same time, the character's talking about things that are happening or have happened. And when somebody says, you know, you're not going to leave me again, we ought to instantly know that's she's already left him once at least before.
Yeah, right? it says volumes with one word.
Yeah, using the word again, right? So we have an insight into what their life has been like in this relationship. And so that's number one, is exposition. And number two is action. When people speak, what they say is an action they take in order to get what they need and want in the moment. But underneath that is what they're really doing. And it's what in the subtext, the action they take in the subtext is what's driving the scene. So when somebody says, I didn't expect that, right? What they're really doing, perhaps, depending, right, is attacking, criticizing the other person for doing something that's completely inappropriate. Mm-hmm. What they say is, well, I didn't expect you to say that. I didn't expect you to do that. I didn't expect that. But what that is a way of attacking another person for inappropriate behavior. And so, right? And so, so the dialogue is the text by which people carry out actions, but underneath the dialogue is the true action. And that's based on a, you know, common sense understanding that people do not say out loud and do out loud what they're really thinking and feeling. Mm-hmm. They cannot. No matter how they try, when they're pouring their heart out and confessing to the worst things they've ever done, mm-hmm. there's still another layer where they're actually begging for forgiveness, let's say. Okay? So by confessing, actually you're begging for forgiveness or whatever it is. And so dialogue is the outer vehicle for interaction. And the great mistake in dialogue is writing the interaction into the dialogue. Instead of having somebody confess, they beg, please forgive me, please forgive me, forgive me, forgive me, right? And if somebody's actually begging, there's got to be another level of what they're really doing underneath the begging. And so you have to, you know, the writer has to think to that. By begging, what that dialogue is actually a mask for manipulating that person, right, to do what you want them to, right? And so exposition, action, okay? And then, you know, just beauty. Just wonderful dialogue in character and all that, but a way of creating a surface that draws us because, you know, we just love to see scenes where characters speak really well. Mm-hmm. Even if gangster talk,
right?
You know, just right. Good gangster talk. It's right.
Yeah.
When gangsters talk to each other and that kind of rap and that kind of, you know, right? That's a form of beauty. It's wonderful. You know, it's pleasurable.
Right.
And so the dialogue ultimately ought to be pleasing, and in a sense of kind of verbal spectacle, and so. That's just you know, that's just three off the top of my head functions, but there's much more.
Right.
And I'm sure like you, we all love wonderful, memorable, quotable dialogue.
Yeah, very much like, so obviously Tarantino and Sorkin and Shane Black and these kind of screenwriters, right. Their dialogue is just, it's poetic in the way that they write sometimes.
It certainly is.
And the genius of them is they're able to do the first two things you said within that poetry, as opposed to just poetry for poetry's sake, which is...
Yes, you know, that's just decorative. but it all happens all at once. You know, you're getting exposition to see who these characters are, whatever. Mm-hmm. Actions or reactions are driving the scene, and it's a pleasure to listen to.
Now, one thing I've noticed in years and even in my own writing, descriptions in a screenplay. A lot of screenwriters, when they're starting out, they feel like it's a novel. So they will write a very detailed description about a scene or about something where, from my understanding over the years, less is more and it becomes more of an exercise in haiku than it is in novel writing. Can you kind of talk a little bit about the importance of compacting your description?
Well, it does need to be economical, of course. On the other hand, it has to be vivid.
Right.
And that's, you know, where does that balance strike? The ambition is to project a film into the reader's head, so that when they read their screenplay, they see a motion picture. Without camera directions, without, you know, smash cut to for transitions and, you know, dolly on and pull focus, whatever. without all that nonsense. You got to use the language and description to create the effect of a motion picture. And you only use the master shots. Only the shots, the angles, the setups, camera setups that are absolutely necessary. And no more. You do not try to direct the film. And instead you project a motion picture into the reader's head and so you need to overwriting, and when it, and in fact when it's not only overwritten but it's not vivid, it's because writers rely on adjectives and adverbs. Mm-hmm. And what they need is to know the names of things. He picks up what we were talking about before, a big nail. Well, you know, big is an adjective. And so put an image in the reader's head. He picks up a spike. Spike is a vivid image. walks slowly across the room. Well, slowly is an adverb.
Right.
And so you name the action. A verb is the name of an action. He pads across the room. He ambles. He strolls. He saunters. He, you know, waltzes. You use an active verb without an adverb, concrete nouns without adjectives, and we see things and we see actions, and it becomes vivid, and it reduces the word count by far. So, here's something you could. Here's a good note for writers. Take your screenplay and search the verb is. Or are, mm-hmm. search is and are throughout your descriptions and eliminate every single one of them. No things are. Nothing is in a screenplay. Everything in a film is alive and action. So, you know, and name the thing. So a line like a big house, there is a big house on a hill. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, what's a big house? A mansion, an estate, a villa? What's a, you know, a hill, a mountain, and turned it into a villa sits. Just that verb, sits, is more active than is. A big house sits with a spectacular view. And so we see a big house up high with a great view, it's an image, and it's active. It sits, it sprawls across whatever. And so active verbs, concrete nouns, and make us see a movie. And every good writer finds their own personal way to do that. Paddy Chayefsky wrote elaborate descriptions. Harold Pinter described nothing. Nothing. He would just go interior kitchen, dialogue, 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 dialogue. Describe nothing. because his attitude was, we all know what a kitchen looks like. And they'll probably play it in the garage anyway. So, but if they mess with my beats of action, reaction, and, you know, in dialogue, then they're in trouble. Okay. So every writer has to find their own way to accomplish the task of vividly projecting a motion picture in the imagination as you turn pages, make them see a movie.
Now, your new book is called Character. And I wanted to ask you a couple questions in regards to character, because arguably, I always like to ask the question, do you start with plot or you start with character? I always say to people, you don't remember, like Indiana Jones's plots aren't nearly as memorable as Indiana Jones. James Bond's plots aren't as memorable as James Bond. Like, I don't, you throw me the plot of Thunderball, I don't remember. I remember scenes, but I do remember James Bond. And that's what draws me back to his stories. So can you talk a little bit about the difference between roles and character?
Well, a role is a generic term. And so hero is a role. Villain is a role. Victim is a role. You know, sidekick is a role. Goon is a role. Shopkeeper is a role. The role is a position in a cast, defined by its relationship to other characters, and or a profession, like waiter, bus driver. Mm-hmm. And they're generic. A role is something waiting to be filled by a character. and so a character comes into a story to fulfill a certain role, but it's a generic to that genre. And so if you have a family, the roles are mother, father, children. Okay. Those are roles. Characters are unique human beings who inhabit those roles. And, and there's a design of a cast such that the protagonist, the central character, that role, is the most complex character of all. And they are depending on the genre, they are the most dimensional character of all. And they are, ideally, they are the center of good. There's a positive human quality not in every way, certainly, but there's some quality within the complexity of that character with which we recognize, we empathize. We recognize a shared humanity. The characters then in orbit around that character, that protagonist, are less dimensional, but they can be dimensional as well. Then you go all the way out to the second and third circles where you have people only playing a role, cashier, restaurant cashier. Okay. Now, even when you're writing a scene where your character goes up to the cashier in a restaurant to pay a bill and discovers that his credit card is canceled, right? You have a clerk standing there who takes the credit card and finds that it's been rejected. That clerk character be very useful to imagine that role very specifically. What kind of human being, you know, is she or he? Because the way in which that clerk, that role, says or responds to your card is canceled, mm-hmm. or your card didn't go through, the way you write the words and gesture for that character gives her a trait. And so roles have traits. And to make even that moment, I mean, there's a human being behind that trait. And so if she's sarcastic, if she's fed up with the job itself or with people whose cards never work, or she's sympathetic because her cards don't work either. So even in a simple role like that, you try to write it with a specific trait in the way in which she deals with that moment, it creates a character for an actor. And so the actor come in there and realize, oh, this is an antagonistic clerk, or this is a sympathetic clerk, or an indifferent, or bored, or falling asleep, or glancing at her watch constantly. She just wants to get out of here. Whatever it is, you give her a trait, and that makes her a character. She starts to come to life, and it gives the actor something to hang their performance on. and so dimensions, the protagonist is the most dimensional of all. Dimensions are contradictions within the nature of the character. And so you populate that protagonist with. In my book on character, I look at characters. Everybody from Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey as an eight-dimensional character, all the way up to Tony Soprano as a 12-dimensional character, Walter White as a 16-dimensional character. The complexity of character today, given long-form television especially, is becoming just astronomical. And then you have to give all the... Then every one of these dimensions, if the character is kind and cruel, okay? Sometimes they're kind, sometimes they're cruel. Therefore, you're going to need a cast of characters where the protagonist, when they meet character A, they treat them kindly. Character B, they treat with a slap or with cruelty. And so you need to design a cast around each other characters so that whenever any two characters meet, they bring out sides of their dimensionality or traits of behavior that no one else brings out of them. And so every single character is designed that whenever they encounter any other character, they bring out each other's qualities in ways that no other character does. And when you have a, you know, when you have that kind of cast where every single character services every other character and no redundancies, every relationship is unique. Every relationship develops a different aspect or a different dimension. Then you have a fascinating group of people that creates a world that the audience can really
dive into.
Dive into.
Now,
you know, when characters behave toward each other in the same way, no matter who it is, it's A, boring, and two, it's false. People do not treat other people, different people, the same. Everybody behaves in a uniquely, subtly, but uniquely different way, depending upon the relationship. And that takes a lot of concentration and imagination in the writer to realize that every relationship brings out different sides of a character's nature.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests, Robert. What are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
See, I don't answer that question.
Okay.
For this reason, I don't want people to copy anybody.
Okay, fair enough.
And so if I say, you know, if I name my, you know, my favorites, like, say, Chinatown, people, you know, then run to study Chinatown and emulate it. And that's a mistake. The really important question to ask people is, what's your favorite genre? Because they should be writing the kind of films they love.
That's a good point.
What I love, what are my favorites, may have nothing to do with their favorites. And so the first question is, you know, what do you love? What kind of movies do you go to see? What kind of things do you read? What do you love? And then seek out those. And the second thing is that if I name favorites, and they're pieces of perfection, okay? What does that teach the writer? They get a model of perfection. Great, okay? That's important. You should understand, you should have an ideal what you're trying to achieve. But one of the ways to achieve it is to study bad movies. Break them down and ask yourself, why is this film so boring? Why can't I believe a word of it? Why does this fail? And break it down and study it to answer, what's this, what does it lack, what went wrong, etc. Okay? And then rewrite it.
Interesting.
Rewrite it. Fix that broken film. Because that's what you're going to do as a writer. Your first draft is going to suck. And you're going to go in and try to fix your broken script. Try to bring it to life. Try to, you know, cut it, edit it, shape it, rewrite it, reinvent it. You're going to re it over and over again, right? Having fixed broken films, not just one, but many, 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 take bad movies, study them, and make them work, is practice for what you're going to have to do with your own screenplay. Because it's not going to work in the beginning. It's going to need a lot of work to work. And so having rewritten bad films to make them work is a real learning experience. And so I say, yeah, study good films of your genre so that you have an ideal that you're trying to achieve. Rewrite the bad ones to teach yourself how to fix broken work. And that's a personal choice. I can't say what that should be for those people. Every one of them loves whatever they love, which may or may not be what I love.
Now, where can people find out more about you, and where can they purchase your new book, Character?
Amazon.
It's pretty much it nowadays, isn't it?
Huh?
Amazon.
No. Bookstores, I'm sure, are opening up. Mm-hmm. And if you love bookstores as I do, you can go to a bookstore and get it. But the most direct way, it'll be there on your porch the next morning. It's incredible what they do, what Amazon does. But I'm sure, that the other Barnes and Nobles too, or whatever it is. But yeah, it's very simple. You just go to Amazon.com, right? Just write the word McKee. Mm-hmm.
And it'll pop up.
Up comes story, dialogue, now character in hardcover, and in audio, and in Kindle,
and everything else. And then, how can people learn more about you and what you offer?
We go to McKeeStory.com. McKeeStory.com will take you to our website. And we have a upcoming, we've been doing webinars now for a year and a half since the plague hit us. Mm-hmm. And they've been very successful, very, very pleased with it. And in July, we're doing a series on action.
Nice.
On the action genre. These are every Tuesday, three Tuesdays in a row. And they're 2-hour events, hour and a half worth of lecture and a half hour of Q&A. Then on Thursday, I give an additional 2 hours of Q&A.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because I realized how important it is for people to get answers to things they're working on. So so Tuesdays and Thursdays for 3 weeks in a row. There's 4 hours of material each week. We will look at the action genre in depth with lots of illustrations and examples and whatnot. And I love giving these action webinars. It's a favorite of mine, action.
I love a good action movie is hard to come by nowadays. So I appreciate it. Robert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to my audience. And I appreciate all the work that you have done over the years and helped so many screenwriters as well. So thank you so much for everything you do.
It was a lovely chat. Great chat. Nice talking to you.
I want to thank Robert so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Robert. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including Robert's new book, Character, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/513. And guys, I have many more surprises coming up for you before the year is out. So keep checking in on the podcast. I think you guys are going to be very, very excited by some of the guests that I have coming up. So thank you again for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.